This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, October 11th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. What predicts how well young people will perform in school? How has a group of charter schools in New York done so very well? Robert Pondicio spent a year in a Success Academy school. The book detailing his observations is How the Other Half Learns, Equality, Excellence, and the Battle Over School Choice. This book is in the trenches, as it were. You spent a year at a Success Academy, and we'll get into that. I guess, did you have particular expectations going into this that were immediately dashed?
Wow, what a good question. And I have to challenge myself to recapture my mindset walking in, because now, you know, you can't forget what you know and what you've seen and what you've learned. I think, like a lot of folks in New York, I've been fascinated by Success Academy for a very long time. And yeah, it's about the test scores. But, you know, there's more to a school than the test scores. But the test scores are just, how can I put this without seeming outrageous? They were just too good to be true. I think I wrote a piece in the Daily News some years ago, and I made the analogy that I didn't know if Eva Moskowitz was the Michael Jordan of testing or the Mark McGuire. And what that means, if you're a sports fan, is, you know, Michael Jordan was this transcendent athlete, and Mark McGuire was a steroids cheat. So, you know, having been in the trenches myself, teaching in the very same neighborhood where I where I was covering Success Academy, it just seemed these scores were too good to be true. And in particular, their ELA scores. I mean, I don't want to divert the conversation in a different direction. It doesn't always surprise me when schools can put points on the board quickly for math. It's a school-based subject. It's not as subject to influences outside the classroom. ELA is really, every input in a child's life builds language proficiency or fails to. So the fact that their ELA scores were as remarkable as they were, not as good as math, but still quite good, that to me was the thing that said, there's something going on here that I don't understand, because I don't know how you get to scores like that in a community like this.
Who is Eva Moskowitz? Talk about her a little bit.
Wow. Do people really not know who Eva Moskowitz is? My credulity is strained. I kid, but only slightly. She is a deeply polarizing figure. Donald Trump asked her to be education secretary, and she turned him down. She is a former city councilman, a former, I believe, history professor at the University of Virginia, and founded Success Academy about a dozen years ago, after having been kind of the teachers union's Torquemada as a city council person. So she kind of walked in the door with a well-articulated set of views about education and about what low-income kids of color needed to achieve. So she started with the one school that's now grown to about 50 schools in about a dozen years. And what makes her such a polarizing figure, in addition to kind of just being, you know, politically visible, is that there's no such thing as a bad Success Academy school by the standard of test scores. I always feel the need to caveat that. There's other things that makes a school good, bad, or indifferent. But to my knowledge, there's no other charter network in America that has as many schools as she has without a single obvious, visible weak sister. And so I'm not the only one who's been fascinated about how does she do this. There have been any number of people who are saying, you know, not just, oh, she's cheating, but, oh, it's the money she's raising from private philanthropy. She's creaming kids. She's doing all these other nefarious things. So I don't think anybody particularly wants to be controversial or polarizing. She certainly does not shrink from a fight.
There is, you mentioned cream skimming, which is a concern that a lot of in the public school establishment have mm-hmm. concerns about, either through vouchers or scholarship tax credits, right, or even charter schools,
right,
have this concern that young people who are predisposed to do better in school, either through their own acumen or through super engaged parents who are
you know, delivering a lot of words around mm-hmm. the house as the kids are very young.
Setting high expectations at home, et cetera.
Absolutely. Sure. So what does cream skimming look like in the context of Success Academy?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's really important to be specific about terms and frankly, probably more specific than I was in writing the book. Okay, so the conventional wisdom has been for years that Success Academy gets these stellar results by, call it what you will, creaming, by cherry picking. In other words, the theory is that they hand select the best and the brightest, even in, you know, low income communities, and then they counsel out, and I'm making air quotes, which listeners can't see, around the words counsel out, the laggards, the difficult to teach, the behavior problems, etc. And so that what you end up with is this kind of, you know, this all star team of, you know, 10-year-olds who just crush the state tests. No evidence of that, but what I write in the book, and what is I guess proven to be somewhat controversial, is that she's not cherry picking students, she's cherry picking parents. And that's a verbatim quote. And I wish I'd said it differently, because cherry picking implies that it is the school that is doing the picking. It's not. It's the parents who are self-selecting, cherry picking themselves, so to speak. That doesn't make it uncontroversial. I mean, I describe this at great length in the book. Like every oversubscribed charter school, Success Academy has lotteried in admissions. So this gives the impression, or it appears to be a randomly selected group of parents and kids. But there's any number of steps in between winning a seat in the lottery and actually enrolling and starting school several months later. So first you win the lottery, then you're invited to a so-called welcome meeting, then you have to do a confirm your interest email, then there's this a lot of the standard paperwork, then there's a uniform fitting, and then there's a dress rehearsal before school starts. By the way, I should mention that the vast majority of Success Academy students start in kindergarten, so the dress rehearsal is to orient them as small children to what they're gonna see when they come to school. So at each one of these steps, the welcome meeting, the uniform fitting, et cetera, parents who do not show up and do not communicate, looking for an alternate day, et cetera, are dropped from the process. So, and by the way, the welcome meeting itself, there's a lengthy chapter in the book describing that. It's I don't think it's inaccurate to describe that as kind of a cross between a revival meeting and Scared Straight. They are quite emphatic about what they stand for and what they will not stand for, as it were. So, as one person leading one of these meetings said, "We're not Burger King. You don't get to have it your way," meaning that we've got this curriculum, we've got these behavior standards, we've got these uniforms. We suspend kids as early as kindergarten, and if you don't like it, then we're not the school for you. So they could not be clearer about who they are. So this gives parents an opportunity to say, I want that for my kid, or no, I do not want that for my kid. This is somewhat controversial within the charter school world. A lot of schools don't go to these extremes of kind of culture setting and culture keeping. But I do think it just doesn't make sense to pretend that it does not set the conditions that allow these stellar results to occur. In other words, you've got parents who are voting with their feet, not once, but repeatedly, saying, yes, this is what I want, or at least willing to go along with it in order to get their kids this kind of education. I just don't know that you're able to get these kind of results without that kind of exercise in culture setting and culture keeping.
You mentioned that this type of cherry picking, creaming, cream skimming of young people and parents is not uncontroversial. You say, in fact, it's quite controversial. But to the extent that what the schools are selecting for and what the parents are selecting for is a school that it requires a great deal of engagement, places a lot of demands on parents. What are the complaints that you hear from the public school establishment?
Sure. Well, I mean, there are, first of all, complaints from folks who just think that the style of education on offer at Success Academy is just inappropriate for children. I mean, I personally don't. I didn't find them to be harsh and militaristic. I found them to be mostly warm and engaging. You know, tough love, as I say in the book, but still warm and not harsh and militaristic. But the soul of the complaint is probably this kind of internecine battle between ed reformers and traditional public school supporters. And the latter will want to say, ha, see, we told you that this was going on, so it's unfair to compare. And my answer is, well, that's right. It is unfair to compare. But follow that idea where it leads. Are we in the business of making fair comparisons, or are we in the business of educating children? You know, if you think a school system exists for the purpose of making comparisons and that everybody must be the same, well, I guess there's an argument to be made. It's not an argument that I would make or support. But I don't think that traditional public school people are wrong to say that, or to be, you know, have their knickers in a twist, as it were, and saying that they've been, you know, dealt with unfairly because of these unfair comparisons. So, where, in other words, follow this argument where it leads. If you're a traditional public school supporter, would you say, we told you that Success Academy is different than us, and therefore no one should be allowed to go there? Well, no. I don't think that's a valid argument whatsoever. You know, does it make any sense? And I should very quickly add, the opposite argument that charter school folks and ed reform folks have made for years, you know, peddling the idea that, look, these schools are just the same and the only difference is the door that the kid walks in the morning. Well, I don't think that's true either. So I think, you know, we have to be a little bit more clear-eyed about, you know, the conditions under which kids go to school. And, you know, again, not to put too fine a point on it, but not treat children as public property. In other words, traditional school advocates are right to say that it's unfair and it makes their lives difficult When children with the most engaged parents leave and go to not just Success Academy, but another charter school. But it doesn't seem morally right to say, therefore, they must stay in the low-performing school.
An attorney that I know fairly well, who's recently retired from the Institute for Justice, Dick Comer, has spent a lot of time arguing cases before courts on behalf of parents who want to educate their children in some particular way. He made a point about public schools that has really stuck with me, and any regular listener to this program will have probably have heard me say this a couple of times. And his argument is essentially that wealthier parents have sort of an ace in the hole in a even when they do send their kids to public school, and part of that is that their concerns simply are going to be heeded a lot more than parents who are unable to take their children somewhere else.
Yeah, I think that's right. And to make an even broader, more simple point, you know, affluent Americans enjoy already something very close to perfect school choice. So if you have the means, you know, the sufficient funds to opt out of the public school system altogether, well, there are, you know, depending on where you live, any number of perfectly fine private schools who are happy to take your money. Not just private schools, but religious schools as well. You have the ability, more often than not, to pick up and move. You know, I live in the New York area, so an affluent family that had a tough time getting into one of the elite private schools in the Upper East Side can certainly pick up today and move to, you know, Greenwich or Scarsdale or, you know, Montclair, New Jersey, or Jericho on Long Island. Success Academy, by the way, beats, at least if test scores matter to you, their test scores are higher than those places, which is interesting. But the larger point is all of these things that the parents at Success Academy are self-selecting for: school safety, high expectations, a rigorous school culture and curriculum. Parents, white and affluent parents, can achieve with very little difficulty. So the curious argument here is, if you want to say that this is unfair, what Eva Moskowitz and Success Academy are doing. Why is it suddenly only unfair when somebody figures out a way to offer this to low-income Black and brown people?
You mentioned safety. You mentioned test scores. I looked at the Success Academy's website recently, and test scores are front and center. Certainly the public school establishment, part of what they care about a great deal is test scores.
I'm not sure that's true.
Oh, really?
I wonder if the public school establishment cares about test scores or whether that's a condition that we've imposed upon them under the broad banner of accountability.
So to what extent is that number one for these parents?
Oh, I think it's a really interesting question. I mean, you know, I say this all the time. I think my ed reform credentials are in pretty good order. I teach to this day, at least part-time at a charter school. I'm a unrepentant choice guy. You know, I don't have an issue with testing and accountability. You know, there's a but coming, and here it is. But all of this has had a deleterious effect on a place called school. You know, I'm old enough to remember going to school one day in sixth grade and finding out we're sitting for a standardized test that day. And that was it. In other words, there was no prep. It was not a, you know, it was not the reason that we sent kids to school. I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that in some places, kids can get the sense that the reason they go to school is to take a test, a math test and a reading test each spring. It's become, you know, to use the obvious cliche, the testing tail is wagging the schooling dog. Now, you know, there are some folks who are enthusiastic about this. There's a lot of folks who obviously are not enthusiastic about this. I'm very much in the middle. Insofar as I don't much like for how the way that testing has kind of upended the culture of education, but I don't romanticize or oversimplify the idea that it used to be better. It did not used to be better. You know, it's a Hobson's choice. I guess it's not Hobson's choice. Pick a better analogy. It is. I can't come up with an analogy. It's there's no perfect way to do this, but those who wanted to say, throw out all the tests, just trust the teachers and send more money. Well, that's not going to work either. If we didn't have testing, we would simply go back to, you know, just screwing poor kids. Forgive my bluntness.
So the parents, how important is testing and test scores to parents?
Right. I assume it's very important to them because I assume they have been led to believe, as many of us have, that that's how we know a good school. Now, for what it's worth, I think it's a lot more subtle and nuanced than that. But to the degree to which testing is the coin of the realm, parents, I think, have probably at least some significant subset of them probably think, like a lot of people do, by their test scores shall we know them. So I think they can be forgiven for assuming that you want to pick a school with best test scores because a generation of ed reformers have tried to convince all of us that that's the case. What's interesting to me, if I can answer a question that you didn't ask, even though test scores are the straw that stirs the drink at Success Academy, I came away thinking that they were really less important than the culture. Now, this gets complicated because, you know, it would be just incorrect to pretend that Success Academy is not dominated by testing concerns. I mean, they put test prep on steroids, as it were. They are aggressive about it. But what's interesting to me, and again, you know, I found the culture there fairly, you know, warm and engaging. It's fascinating to me if you think about this from the perspective of a low-income family of color or a kid of color who probably doesn't have the mental model of this. But put yourself in the place or in the mindset of that 10-year-old kid in the South Bronx who is good at school because the test says he's good at school. And his teachers are deeply invested in him doing well on this test. And nobody's telling him that this is easy. Quite the opposite. They tell them that it's hard. And then he goes out and he gets, as we would say, a level 4, the highest score on the test. But not just that, his friends do. Their friends do. His parents are in on this. His friends' parents are in on this. It creates a culture that, in my mind, cannot do anything other than change the relationship of a community like the South Bronx to a place called school. Suddenly, it is not a place where you go to learn how little is thought of you and how narrow your horizons are. It's a place where you go home thinking, hey, I'm good at this. I'm good at school. And there are people here who are helping me with this, and I'm bought in. So in other words, that culture of success, no pun intended, validated by state tests, in this case, I think is may quite possibly be creating something far more powerful than just the test scores themselves.
And now the unpleasant matter of
okay.
Scale.
Yeah.
It's sort of amazing to me that there are so many of schools that are success academies and that they seem to perform consistently well. Mm-hmm. But in reading your book, it seems like, you know, when Eva Moskowitz says that, you know, this isn't for everyone, she's really including teachers in that too.
Yeah, that's a fair point. In retrospect, I mean, I'm a second career teacher. I didn't set foot in a classroom as a teacher until I was in my late 30s, almost 40. I sure wish that I had trained at a success academy. I mean, I would have been far better prepared to teach fifth grade at PS 277 down the block from where I was embedded at Success Academy than I was prepared by New York City, the United Federation of Teachers, and others. So I wish I'd had that training. But I did, to your point, when I spent my year at that school, I constantly thought, could I do this? Would I want to work here? And the answer, candidly, was no. And let me be really clear. That's probably because of who I am and where I am in my career. I'm like 56 years old. The idea of being able to maintain this level of intensity all day, every day, is almost unthinkable to me. You know, it's a very young place. Most of the teachers there are visibly in their 20s. You rarely see anybody who is, older than that. And I don't think I saw anybody in a classroom who was my age. You know, there is a level of commitment and intensity that sure, it just burns them out. But what's interesting is that it doesn't seem to affect their results, which is another fascinating point, because that calls into question one of the orthodoxies of education, that, you know, think of how much better we would be if we could make teaching a lifelong career and teachers get better as they get older or get more experience. You know, there are not many examples from the Success Academy model that I think would translate to K-12 at large. The intensity notwithstanding, the thing that I think enables them to get good results with relatively inexperienced people is that they've got a curriculum and they've got a teaching model that gets to competence very, very quickly. I don't want to wonk out on you, but the average American teacher spends a bewildering amount of time pulling together his or her own resources. There was a study by Rand within the last couple of years that I think I've got this right from memory, like 98% of American teachers get materials on their own to teach. That does not happen at Success Academy. They've got a curriculum. It is provided. They still do lesson planning, but it's what they call intellectual preparation. It's preparing to teach that lesson. It's practicing. They spend a lot of time studying student work, giving feedback. They spend a lot of time building relationships with students and parents. All of that is more valuable than spending 20 or 30 hours a week on Google and Pinterest saying, what am I going to teach tomorrow? So if there's any one lesson that can be translated from Success Academy to K-12 at large, I hope it would be that one.
States vary widely when it comes to how charter schools get approved, how they qualify for state funding, and for good reason. It's often difficult to start a new school and then attach yourself to the taxpayer dime. To the extent that there are policy hurdles for us to try to discover all the would-be Eva Moskowitzes out there who would like to start and could successfully run a network of charter schools. What are those policy hurdles?
Yeah, it's hard to say with a broad brush because they are different from state to state. Broadly speaking, I think we are in a moment where charter schools are suddenly in bad odor, at least among the Democrats. I mean, if you listen to the rhetoric among the 2020 candidates, they seem to fall into two camps. There are some of those candidates who hate charter schools, and then there are others who really hate charter schools. So that's and that's somewhat surprising because it wasn't that long ago. I mean, within the last 10 years, that there was something approaching bipartisan consensus on the need for charter schools, and that took some political bravery from the Democrats, since they tend to be more aligned with the teachers' unions. That's all fallen apart. And I'm not sure that it's coming back again anytime soon. I mean, I'm sure there are obviously some number of states that are still quite charter friendly, but in blue states, as it were, it feels like it's cold out there and getting colder. So that's the most obvious one is that the politics around charter schools have changed. Also, that we have to be careful. I work for a think tank that is an education reform and charter school advocate, but I don't want to be less than clear-eyed about it. One of the reasons I wrote this book is because I just find some of the rhetoric around charter schooling and ed reform unsatisfying. In other words, I just don't know that it makes sense to continue to try to beat on traditional public schools and say, "Hey, you're all bad guys," and we need to have charter schools to rescue people from them or kids from them. We say all the time in education that we need to meet the children where they are. We should be saying we need to meet families where they are. One of the interesting things about Success Academy families, I don't have data on this, but it's quite observable. In communities like the South Bronx, they are visibly, a certain kind of family is visibly overrepresented. They tend to be married, employed, more often than not, religious and/or spiritual. I can't tell you how many families said to me, "Well, if I had the money, I'd send my kid to Catholic school." We ed reformers, I think, I think this is true of people in general in education. We tend to view urban communities in these families in one of two ways, neither of which is helpful. Either we assume that everybody in a impoverished inner city neighborhood is dysfunctional, and we view these communities through a lens of dysfunction, and we pretend that these together families, as it were, don't exist. Or we look at these families who are married, employed, ambitious for their children, and we say, well, those kids will be fine. We don't have to worry about them, and that may be even worse. I mean, that's just horribly condescending. So you need a Success Academy in a sense to meet those families where they are, because if there is not a school or a charter school for those families, then they will be lost, as I say, to the dull hum of mediocrity in low-performing neighborhood schools, and those children will march in place. They will not be given what they need to be upwardly mobile. If you view those communities, purely through a lens of dysfunction, then you will not give them the academic challenges that more fortunate kids get.
With all that as the backdrop, are there clear lessons for policy that you feel more confident about now than before this experience of writing this book?
Yeah, I think I'm going to give the old Paul Tsongas answer. That's a really interesting question. Let me try to evade it. because, honestly, let me take some time and try to give you a thoughtful answer. I walked into Success Academy, and I think I say this in the book, expecting to write a book about curriculum and instruction, because that's what I write about. I mean, that's kind of most of my work in education and education policy. Change the inputs, change the outputs. I ended up writing a book about school culture and the conditions, the classroom conditions that are created when you get every adult in a child's life, including their parents, significantly, pulling in the same direction. Well, school culture is a really difficult challenge for policymakers to solve for. I mean, look at the response to this book, where people are focusing on the mechanisms that we described earlier, whereby parents self-select into these schools, and their hair is on fire over it. And perhaps that should have been predictable, because that's not the way we do it, right? You're supposed to do this for every child. You're supposed to be able to take, regardless of a kid's background or misfortunes, you're supposed to raise that kid to his or her academic best level. Well, that's a little naive. It's very, very hard for even the best schools to do that. So what if culture is the thing that makes the difference? I mean, now, you know, if anybody who's listening to us has spent any time working in a Catholic school or went to one, they're like rolling their eyes right now and saying, well, duh, of course. That's, you know, we've known this forever in Catholic education, and they're right. But significantly, Catholic schools are not public schools. And in most places, you don't get to attend a Catholic school on the public dime. But if school culture is the thing that really attaches kids to a school, that creates the conditions that make them want to acculturate themselves to high academic achievement because that's the culture of the school, well, that's very, very hard to do unless you allow parents to self-select for that specific school culture. You can't impose it, to put it bluntly. You can't just take the first 100 families off the street and do Success Academy because it does make prodigious demands on parents. And you can't make them do it. You know, Success Academy uses the nag factor quite successfully to create a culture where parents go along with the program or you know, they face a lot of resistance. But you simply could not demand that parents do this. You know, and I don't mean to single out the Success Academy culture. You couldn't just assign kids to Catholic school. You couldn't just assign kids to a Montessori school. You couldn't just assign kids to any school that has a particular way of doing things. So if culture is the thing, and I mean school culture, I want to be very precise about that. If a particular school culture and getting, you know, high levels of buy-in across a school community, if that's the thing that makes it work, I simply don't know how you account for that in our current policy.
Robert Pondicio is author of How the Other Half Learns, Equality, Excellence, and the Battle Over School Choice. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.